Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Well, it is here, the 200th special anniversary show for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me today. And as we do every once in a while, we try to put on a show, an episode where we have a lot of listener questions because I get things all the time. And you know, you can simply ask at any time to ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And that's me, Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. We have lots of questions to get to today, lots of great questions to get to that were sent in by email, lots of people from around the world, all over the world, that ask questions. And thanks a lot for doing so. Thanks a lot for listening. Before we get to some of those questions, I thought what we'd do is spend a little bit, just a small amount of time, talking about some of the things that are going on around the world. If you haven't noticed, there is a breakout of protests that is unfortunately occurring in many of the areas around the world that have had monarchies, dictatorships, or other kinds of non-democratic rule for many years. And at first you would think that some of the areas, like the oil-rich areas, may have spread some of the wealth out to their countrymen. But no, really, some of that has not happened. But yet, at the same time, they do pass on much of the increases in costs when it comes to food, etc. We see that throughout the Middle East and part of North Africa, we're seeing just horrible, horrible protests go on. Lots of government retaliations just this weekend that we saw, and it's really unfortunate. And what the unfortunate situation, aside from the devastation to humanity that is occurring over the years, and now that is being further, harmed, I guess, in terms of the outright human consequence that we're seeing, is that we all suffer in one way or another, and it's really very troubling. Now, aside from obviously the difficulty we all have with watching what goes on from a human standpoint, we also see that financially, you know, things like oil have reached a 21 month high right now. We're at 103 or 103 and a half on Brent Sweet crude. We're seeing that about a 3.5 to 4% jump in prices over the last week, plus over the weekend, seeing another couple of percent, 3% on oil. And that's really troubling. That is going to unquestionably put a dent in the global recovery from however you look at it. Yet at the same time, for the most part, up until now, investors have been, you know, just saying, well, it's the Middle East, it's not here. And that is a really big issue, because when these things do start to mount and eventually start to come home, there's a real concern about that. And you have to wonder how much of our global-based companies here, the companies that do business around the world and, you know, import various materials from around the world, are going to also be subjected to problems. One of the biggest issues we have right now is Saudi Arabia. You know, who would have thought that in Saudi Arabia there would be these kind of uprisings so quickly? But you know what we're seeing is that in all these uprisings, when many of the governments have provided a benefit to the people that are protesting, for example, they say, okay, you know what, we're going to have open and fair elections, or we're going to absorb some of the inflation, or whatever they say, it spurs another similar situation where they're unhappy. You know, again, we're seeing in China, they're passing on higher gas prices. They just raised the gas prices this weekend. In Vietnam, they have a significant inflation problem, and the government just increased the overall electric rates in that country. And the food price escalation is continuing, and that is hurting many of the poorer nations. We've talked about this at length. Ben Bernanke has denied that his quantitative easing and dropping of the dollar has caused any of this, but we all know better, and it is absolutely a tragedy that we are allowing for any kind of human suffering around the world just to make sure that our economic system is solid. It's actually disgusting. I don't know how you feel about it, but at the same time, you have to wonder how this all comes around full circle one day. Does it help that we have mass rioting protests and all sorts of major countries around the world seeing this kind of problems on a, again, on a humanitarian, political, and economic basis? I don't think so. That doesn't help us. So I think that what we have to really recognize here is that with all that's gone on, all the help that we've seen from the EU and also from the United States to revitalize our economies, and China, what they're doing in terms of hoarding of the various materials and foodstuffs, that, you know, we have to rethink how we're actually going to go into a recovery mode. But anyway, we could talk about that at a later date. We're going to bring on Jim Rogers one of these days when he finishes his tour. We're going to bring Das back and talk about that. And I'm sure you have some definite ideas about that. You know, this is something that most people don't just sway one way or the other. They definitely have an idea of what they think about this. And I can't imagine it's that much different than what we're talking about here. But anyway, we digress on that. How do you protect your portfolio? You can look at the VIX. We picked up some of the VIX options for our clients last week. We've made pretty good money, surprisingly, even though the market has stayed rather stable. Just before the options expiration, Wednesday and Thursday, it's amazing how the VIX has actually moved up so dramatically. And you can do that through options or the VXX. We talked about that with Terry Bedford. I talked with Terry afterwards, and I discussed that I thought that the VXX or the VIX was such a heavily shorted trade right now that any movement to the upside could put in a very significant short squeeze short term on the VIX. He agreed. And, you know, that's what probably we're going to see if we continue to witness much of the ongoing, you know, problems throughout the Middle East and around the world. So, you know, think about that if you want to put in some protection for your portfolio. In addition, I'll mention that we have a lot of important things coming out this week. Economics, we have durable goods that are coming out later in the week, of course, and not to mention initial claims, et cetera. You know, and what we have to be watching for right now is any chink in the armor in terms of if there is inflation creeping into the system. Clearly, we saw the CPI have some inflation recently, and we're seeing it in a variety of other areas. But that's the big issue, because so far manufacturing hasn't skipped a beat. We've also seen pretty much company after company beating analyst expectations, who are still very much on the low side of both EPS and revenue. So that's good. I mean, that leads to some further upside in the markets. But the euphoria that we've seen of late, with a lot of money being put into the domestic markets in the U.S., and that has been on the heels of a lot of money coming out of emerging markets, as well as the fact that inflationary concerns that have, you know, cropped up in the U.S. are, in fact, going to draw in money, because if, in fact, the dollar comes up in value and the equities come up in value, it's a double benefit for those that are, you know, utilizing that as a currency play, inflation play, and as an earnings growth play. So that's kind of like the setup right now of what's gone on. But again, this show is really going to be dedicated to the whole idea of, you know, your questions. So why don't we just get right into that? And again, thanks for joining me today. I do appreciate all your questions. Special anniversary edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 200. So our first caller comes to us from Luxembourg on the Skype line. His name is Jaib. Hey, Jaib, how are you?
Great. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a great podcast. I had a question. You did a few weeks ago, you did a little feature about iPhone applications, and yeah. I'm looking for solutions for on the PC. And in the past, I've been using Yahoo Finance for charting and Excel with web queries and things to monitor portfolios and things. And I was wondering if you have any ideas what cost-effective programs there might be out there which one could use.
Yeah. So here's a good question, because you know, one of the things that we'd like to do is obviously on the go, all of us want to check what's going on. Now, I'll tell you, I think you mentioned Yahoo Finance in your email too. There's a great little app with Yahoo Finance for the iPhone and for, I guess, Android and all that. But on a PC, there's a couple of options. Now, here's the question. Are you looking to do research, track, chart? What is your main issue?
My main, both tracking and keeping my portfolios there, put alerts on them, possibly even get those alerts pushed out. I'm using a program currently which actually does do that, called Stock Market Eye. But also also having watch lists and being quickly able to, you know, just add a symbol, look at the charts, see the fundamentals, rather than having to go online and doing this through Yahoo is a slow process, really, and not really.
Yeah, no, ideal. I hear you. The problem is, I'm going to be honest with you. First of all, we use something called TradeStation here for just kind of the day-to-day, tick-by-tick information about what's happening. You can probably download that and use it. It's not very expensive, but it gives you great charting, watch lists. You can do alerts. There is some basic fundamental analysis that you can look at. The problem what you have is that meshing the fundamental, the guts of the company into the charting software and having that isn't necessarily the easiest thing. So what I would say to you, TradeStation is something that you want to look into. I would look into for tracking a portfolio that as well. You know, the other thing that you could look at when it comes to simply looking at things like Google Finance, you could actually use the Google spreadsheet and grab all the data. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but you can create a Google spreadsheet that will allow you to hook up directly, very easily, to Google Finance, so that you could look at a variety of things like various ratios and pricing and things of that nature in a spreadsheet that's live all the time. And this way you could kind of just drop in a list of symbols and just copy down like on a spreadsheet. And it's almost like doing a web query that you would do in Excel, but it's already on the web.
But it is on the web.
So what I want you to do is look. Yeah, so look, it's free too. Go to the Google Docs, look up the Google Docs Finance Mnemonics, and see what they have to say there. We utilize that for DH Unplugged. When you have a look at the stocks that we have on the DH Unplugged site, we use it automatically updates pricing and all that, and you can do anything if you're good at spreadsheets, you could set it up really easy.
Okay, that would be one option. But if you wanted a solution where you could be offline and still have your data locally on your PC, is there a way that you could do?
No, there's really nothing out there. I'm not aware of anything that's offline that you can have data, right? I mean, what could be offline and still have all that data? I mean, that's a massive data dump. And even the programs like the S&P that we used to use and a few others that would do that in the past, you'd still have to update overnight. And nothing, even the Bloomberg system that we have, I'm not aware of anything that you can get just offline entirely.
Yeah.
Because you have to get updates,
right? Yeah, but if you're for short period offline and you want to do some research and you're going through your figures and looking at fundamentals, perhaps for that you don't have to be online. And
I am not aware of anything.
Okay. No, but anyway, this is giving some ideas. And
And one day we're going to be like, do you mean offline? I mean, We're close to that right now.
Impossible to be offline.
Exactly.
No, that's great. That gives a few thoughts.
I hope I answered your question. Keep in touch, and thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, next up we have Mike from Tacoma, Washington. Man, how do you deal with that weather, buddy boy?
Well, I try to do my best. I moved back up here from Los Angeles a few years ago, and I got used to the California weather for quite a while, so now I have to try and get back in the habit of dealing with the rain and cold weather. That's for sure.
Yeah, I hear you. So what's going on? How can I help?
Well, the question that I have is, what advice would you give to an amateur investor who has become recently discouraged with investing in individual stocks? Because it seems like I'll find a couple of stocks online that I'm interested in. I'll do my fundamental analysis, my technical analysis, and all of the signs point to the price on the stock going higher. So I'll invest a bunch of money, and then I'll slowly watch over the next few months as the price of the stock goes down, 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 and next thing I know, it's down 30 or 40%.
Wow.
So what advice would you give to someone that is kind of new to the game, and they find a stock, and they think everything's going to go great with it, but then it turns out that that wasn't the case?
Well, you know, a couple of things. Let me ask you. So then do you sell the stock? You sell the stock, right? Or something? What happens?
Typically, I'll try and put a stop loss where I'll lose maybe only 10 or 15%.
Mm-hmm.
So I try and limit my losses that way. But then on the flip side, maybe I'll do an analysis on a company and everything points to that particular stock going lower, like the fundamentals don't look good, the technicals don't look good, and so I won't invest in that company, and then a few months later I'll check back in on it, and it's up 60% from the time I looked at it originally.
Let me tell you a couple of things that maybe you need to know as an investor, and this isn't in every single market condition, but this is something I want you to think about. So companies that have really poor fundamentals and that are looking really awful probably only have a couple things they can do. Well, one, they're just going to keep going down and maybe go out of business one day. Maybe they can be bought. Somebody will clean them up. A competitor will merge with them. Or maybe they will clean themselves up. Now, when you look at a stock and you see this godforsaken, horrible balance sheet, right? And you're like, oh, I'm not getting near that stock. Okay, I'm with you on that. And you see the stock is trailing down. It looks horrible. Probably a lot of shorts are in there. You know, if they do any kind of a turnaround and all of a sudden things are looking a little bit better, you know, that stock may get a tremendous boost. On the other hand, the stocks that are looking really good, they've been riding high, that have great fundamentals, they have any kind of missteps, it's all of a sudden all over. So I want you to consider that, you know, when you're looking at stocks, because sometimes there's a lot more that would be, okay, I see this in the past, but the future, what does that hold? That's a very difficult thing to do. The second thing is that I agree with you that setting some kind of a point where you limit your losses. The other thing is when do you buy the stock? Because you could have a great stock in a really bad stock market, and that's not going to work out. You could have a terrible stock in a really good stock market, right? What happens? It goes up. You know, a rising tide lifts all ships. So the other thing is that you have to wonder, what is your goal? Are you finding a stock that you think is really cheap and it looks like it's a good deal and it's going to rise and it's going to be a 50% gainer or something like that? Or do you think this is something that is going to give you an opportunity for a longer term, whatever that time period is? And if something's dropping 20 or 30%, that means that there's a mismatch between whatever you did in your research and what the reality was. Does that make sense?
Right. Okay. Yeah, it does.
So I think that what you want to do is also look at the technicals. They tell a really good story. See if there's a trend that's moving in the right direction, and you know, take a look at what the trend is telling you, and see if that makes any sense. Because if you buy a stock and then it goes down like almost immediately, you know, that's a concern. Did you look at the amount of volume it usually trades? Did you look at how many institutional managers are in it? Did you look at the short interest and things of that nature beyond the fundamentals like PE and all that stuff? PE is crap. Everybody uses PE. You know, that's an old game. That's an old game. You know, forget that. You know, you got to look at more of the inside. You know, how many of the insiders hold? What's the balance sheet look like and things of that nature? And what you should do is probably pick some stocks, do some research if this interests you, and do it. Well, kind of on paper for a little while. Just test it out. You know, put your numbers down. Okay, I'd buy this here. I wouldn't buy that there. And then, okay, I bought some of that. You don't go all in. Maybe I'll go in 50% today. If it moves up a little bit, I'll add 30%. If it goes up even more, I'll add another 20% or whatever the numbers are. And if it goes down, you know what? I'm going to get, you know, squash my losses. But then maybe I'll move back into it if I see it moving back up again.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So don't get discouraged. It's not as easy as it looks from the outside when you just see markets going up, no matter what the news is. You know,
I've definitely learned that.
So just keep on going on. You're doing great. You know, just keep on refining. Find out always what you did wrong. Okay, what did I do wrong here? What did I miss? Why didn't I do that? And then change. Adapt.
Yeah.
All right.
Perfect. All right, great. Well, I appreciate all your great advice and keep up with the good work over there.
Hey, thanks, Mike. We'll talk to you. All right, next up, Rick from all the way from Maine. We got all these cold weather guys coming in. How you doing, Rick?
Good, thanks.
What's going on? What can I help you with?
Well, I'm a small investor, and I often find stocks that I consider a buy, but because I don't have a large amount of money to invest, you know, even $500 or $1,000 sometimes, I find that the only way that I can get into a stock that I'm interested in is through dollar cost averaging,
right?
Which is not a bad thing. I've never been disappointed, really, except that I find that I miss out on a lot because I don't have that opportunity to get in all at once.
Right. Right, right. So you're finding the right buy point, but you just can't get in because you don't have the money to do so, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if if dollar cost averaging is not what I should be doing, should I, you know, are there other options for me? Should I do things differently, or is there maybe a better way to get in?
Right.
You know, and this isn't my only investment. I do have 401k, which I put, you know, I take 15% of my pay and I put it into my 401k.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is kind of my discretionary investment.
All right. So here's the deal. You know, obviously, if you're using like a share builder or some kind of other DCA through the company or whatever, DCA dollar cost averaging, the thing is you're going to do, I don't know, you know, $25, $50, $100 a month, whatever it is. The problem is that you don't have control over the time necessarily. What I would suggest, if what, from what you're telling me, what I would rather you do is do a DCA into your own account, into cash, and then say, here's the deal. Obviously, I can buy a little bit of a stock over time, or I can find that stock that I really like and put in the $500 or $1,000 because I have that in my cash account right now. And unfortunately, listen, not everybody started out buying. Buffett didn't start out buying companies at a time, okay?
Right.
You know, and you look at all the great investors out there, they start out slowly. But I think, though, that, you know, the dollar cost averaging must be very frustrating to you because you want to get into a stock, but you can't. Then you have to diversify, and you can never actually get more money then to put more money in at a timing point that you want. I would say this is going to be frustrating. Either way, it's frustrating. But what I would say to you is save the money for a bigger entry point and then enter at that point.
Okay.
You know, this way you can kind of solve a lot of problems all at once and not have you know, all your money going into all these little pieces over time without your control. Because I think that's, you know, something that you want. And if you are good at what you do in terms of picking positions, et cetera, you know, you can up it and your potential a lot, especially if you're buying at the right point.
I think that sounds great.
Yes, I wouldn't do the share builder and all that. I think that would be, you sound like a young guy anyway, so I wouldn't really do that right now. I think that it would be, you know, better to do a big chunk at a time. So best advice I could give you.
And I've been doing the share builder. I actually have been doing share builder. I actually like it a lot. It offers me a lot of tools that I can't necessarily find or don't have access to. But I you're absolutely right. I get completely frustrated because I'll, you know, if I put in $75 this month, I have to wait till Tuesday to purchase, or I'll have to pay more money for the purchase, or I've just missed the cutoff, so I got to wait another full week to go, and that really does get frustrating for me. I feel like I'm missing out on the right time to buy.
Right, I can imagine. Now, I'm not going to go so far as telling you to go borrow money from a bank and leverage yourself, but I mean, you know, don't get that frustrated.
No, absolutely not. This is really money that, you know, I feel I can put aside and I can use it to have like a nest egg outside of my nest egg.
I hear you.
Something I can really work with.
I hear you. All right, man. Thanks for calling. Thanks for asking your question. Keep on listening. Tell some friends.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, let's see. Next up, Ohio. Eric from Ohio. Hey, Eric.
How you doing, Andrew?
Good.
I love the show.
Hey, thanks. Appreciate that. What's going on?
My question is, everyone talks about how BRIC or emerging nations are growing much more than the developed nations, as their GDP numbers are much higher than ours. But I've read a lot of articles that suggest that a country's stock market performance is not correlated to GDP. So if you accept this thesis, then is it still wise to invest in the BRIC countries, and what's a good strategy?
Right.
Buying individual companies, ETFs, or something else?
You know, this is a really great question because, you know, there's this fixation with GDP around the world, isn't there? And you know, you look at these GDP numbers, but what do they tell you? Well, they tell you obviously the production essentially of a country. The problem these days, though, is there's so much government intervention, stimulus, and government input that it's really, for many countries around the world, it's really giving us a very false picture of long-term GDP. That doesn't mean that the GDP of some of these countries can't continue to do well. But here's the point. If you look at GDP solely as the only place to look at, I think it's an interesting way to look at markets. But at the same time, you need to look at the trend more than just a snapshot. So when we look at the BRIC countries, talking about Brazil, Russia, India, and China. That's the BRIC countries. And these are the, I guess, the emerged of or the top end of the emerging markets, they call that. And clearly these countries have been they're highly populated. They have growing GDP. They have incredible and an enormous appetite for consumption. And these countries also came back well before ours did through the 2008-2009 correction. Even their GDP did. But the problem is then you have to look further. You know, what's the real GDP? In other words, after you look at inflation, I think it's important also. Because if you look at those particular countries, inflation is a real problem, real problem. So now all of a sudden you look at, for example, your India in the BRICS, and they have great GDP, things are going well. But meanwhile, their markets are down like 17% year to date. And you look at Russia, which is actually doing very well. China's not doing very well. And Brazil also is having its difficulties. So here's the thing. You know, if you want to invest in these countries, there's one more thing you need to, I think, be aware of. And that is that you have a built-in currency problem. Because what should be happening is that with these BRIC countries, you know, their currency should be going up in value, and they did, because it's a place that you want to put money because there'll be increasing rates, and as the increasing rates, their currency is better. Okay, so everything is good there. But I think the problem is that for an individual investor, how do you actually research the individual companies? You know, if I said, okay, India, what are you going to buy? Well, you're going to buy Tata. You know, what are you going to buy? A Cognizant. You're going to buy an Infosys. You're going to buy something that has access to the country. You're going to buy, if I say Brazil, Petrobras, Mercado Libre in Argentina. So I think that you have that problem where you don't know, or you may not know exactly what to invest in. And ETFs, I think, are the best place to go. Boring, right. Much more boring, and much more potentially affected by currencies, but diversified at least.
Right.
So now the question is, what's happening? Are you curious about what's going on this year with the BRICS, and why is there problems there?
Well, I mean, it seems that this year is maybe a little bit of a change than last year. I mean, I guess my big question, follow-up question, is sort of just BRICS versus emerging markets in general. Like, if you're going to go the ETF route or some broader index-based route, does it make more sense to just do a broad-based emerging market versus the BRICS? Because emerging market indexes have done, you know, probably just as well, and you don't have that. I mean, you know, and so it seems that, you know, maybe the BRICS aren't all they're cracked up to be now. I mean,
right.
You know, over the last couple of years, they've been okay. But
you have another problem there. If you just go to an ETF, you know, the EEM, the problem is, though, that you have pretty much a static emerging market exposure. Now, you may say, well, that's what I want. I want emerging markets for X reason, Y reason, whatever it is, right?
Right.
I would suggest to you, depending on how much money you have, and most listeners probably have never heard me say this, but I would look for a really good mutual fund manager that has a no-load fund, institutional class if possible, that can actually understand the different iterations, if you will, of all the different areas. So, for example, in the ETF, you may see that it has a standard allocation to Brazil. You know, that's one of the bigger ones,
right.
In China. Well, what if all of a sudden there's political turmoil? Middle East is a perfect example, right? So
yeah. This
political turmoil, you know, may say a guy that said, you know what, I don't want to be in that region for X, Y, and Z reason. He may be wrong or right. But if he has really good team working with him and they are very experienced, maybe a mutual fund that has been able to outperform and does have an emerging markets area could be a good idea. So,
right.
You know, that's actually what we do we do a mixture. We do both ETF and no load, very low cost, institutional class mutual funds for our global allocations. And I don't know, I think that makes a lot more sense because, you know, then you are at least giving some ability for a manager to take over. And the more difficult it is to understand an area, whether it's junk bonds or whether it's emerging markets, I think you have to lead more towards somebody managing it.
Yeah. No,
so,
that seems like a good strategy.
Right. So I think you just do some research, and I'll try to maybe come on and put a list of, I'll write that down on notes, that we'll put a list of some of the emerging market mutual funds and ETFs that we look at. We're a little concerned about emerging markets. A lot of money's been flooding out of that area.
Well, I know it's a hot area now. Maybe it's just there's a rotation going on.
Yep.
or
I agree.
Whatever,
so. Yep, that's exactly what's going on here. So good stuff. All right, Eric, hey, great questions. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
All right, talk to you soon, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, now all the way from Germany, we have Hans. Hey, Hans, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Good. What can I help you with?
Question is, how do you? Is there an indicator that shows when the buyers are coming back or when the sellers are taking over? So something that sort of gives you a feel of where things might be going, or you know, or looking at it from the history, like the MACD is doing for the price action, but more on the volume side.
All right. So basically, you know, it all depends on what we're looking at in terms of, first of all, we have to assume that the market isn't in an everyday I have to buy mode, in that the buyers are just ridiculously buying at any opportunity they have, whether it's, you know, if it's down, they buy, if it's up, they buy. So you know, there is, I think the issue that you need to look at, and it's kind of changed a bit, is, you know, you look at, as easy as this may be, you have to look at volume. I think that's a big picture item, but you also have to look at trend, because lately we have this melt up in the U.S. markets, for example, and you know, around the world. You know, look at the situation in Germany. I mean, the markets just continue to go up, even though all around you have really bad. You know, Germany's economics are good, but the really bad economics around. So right now, the tide that is moving everything in the same direction, I think, is one that you have to be very conscious of. I think there is no unified absolute, because we could say that the market is overbought if we look at the confidence levels that the AA, Association of Individual Investors, puts out. You know, the bullishness hasn't been this high in years. So, you know, that may be good for a while. Who knows where that turns? Mm-hmm. The other thing is, if you look at volume, generally speaking, volume has not been what I would say outrageously benefiting the bulls. Because every time there's a sell-off, the volume moves up, even recently, when there is that one-day sell-off. So, you know, right. I'm going to disappoint you and say that you have to just realize that until the trend changes from an upward slope of a chart, I really, and then breaking down below a breakpoint, I think that you have to realize that the trend is the trend. I mean, if that's as simple as it gets. Well, we seem to have lost Hans there somewhere in the Skypeville of the world. But we'll move on. All the way from Chicago, we're up with Tony. Hey, Tony, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. So what's going on? How can I help?
All right, I've been in cash ever since 06, and I was pretty proud of the fact that I got out then. But how do we know when it's safe to actually get back in the market, considering that the market's being stimulated by everything that the government's doing? Like, how do we know that the economics are real? You hear all these commentators say, oh, it's a real recovery, but how do you know if it's real with all the steroids that are being pumped into it? It's like, if I was analyzing a company, I'd actually back out and make adjustments for this type of stimulation. But how do we look at this objectively and make a decision of it's a time to get back?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me ask you a question. Suppose you went to a restaurant and, you know, you said, I'd like to order a hamburger. And they say, all we have is veggie burgers. And you're like, oh, that's not really a burger. But you say, I'll take it. You ate it. It was good. It was nourishing. Okay? But you really wanted a burger. And you're like, well, I didn't get my burger today. I need my burger. You follow what I'm saying? What's the difference? The facts are that, you know, whether we say this will continue or not, or whether we say it was because of this reason or the other reason, if the money that's going in is stimulating and providing for a recovery or growth or whatever you want to call it, stabilization, whatever you want to call it, and at the end of the day that companies are making more money, regardless of the unemployment rate and all that, who cares if they call it, you know, a hot dog, you know, an ostrich, or, you know, a porcupine? Does it really matter?
Yeah, it does, because I worry what happens when that all that stimulus is gone. You know, did I just high top the market and get it at the high now?
Well, hold on a second. Let's discover just a couple of things here. So the problem is that, you know, you don't want to get into the market, whatever that is, because of its high. And then if you high top it and all of a sudden the stimulus is pulled, you're going to get screwed. Now, this is probably a discussion that you've had with yourself over the last, I'm going to take a stab at this, okay? 12 months.
Yeah,
or so. So now every time you get closer, you're like, oh, I'm not going in, because when I go in, that's it. It's over. I probably, you know, I gave in too fast. And I have to say that there is something to be said about there is a lot of capitulation going on when it comes. But, you know, at the same time, we are seeing that the corporate earnings, forget for a second, entirely forget about the unemployment, the economics, forget about that for just a second. And let's look at the corporate balance sheets. Let's look at the profits and the potential from corporations. And then does that at all, again, putting out the noise of the economics and where the money came from for just a moment, because you don't also know whether or not corporations are making money from stimulus here, or maybe they're getting money because of the growth of the emerging markets or whatever. Does that make a difference to you when you're choosing to invest or not? And also realize that if things get bad, you could always pull out. And, you know, there's no rule that you have to be in or out for a certain period of time. So I think that one thing that you have to start doing is working the, this is so I probably, you heard me say this before, but, you know, working the general trends. Because we could probably make up all sorts of things. I'm looking at an email you sent me here, and you're talking about, hey, what's going on with the lower volume on the up days and the higher volume on the low days? We could probably sit here, you and I, and make all sorts of reasons, you know, why we shouldn't do something. Why we shouldn't invest. Maybe we should go short. Maybe we should sit on the sidelines. But at the end of the day, was that the right decision? So here's what I want to tell you. I want you to think this for a second. Tony, if you're in a room and there's 20 people, all telling you the answer to the question is X, but you believe it's Y, and you firmly believe it's Y, you're wrong. Does that make sense?
Yeah, can you repeat the last part?
I'm saying if you're in a room with 20 people and everybody has the answer to a question is X, and you say it's Y, and you really believe it's Y, and you know, by all accounts, it should be Y, you're wrong. No matter how right you think you are. At the end of the day, the direction of the market is the direction of the market. Now, there may be, you know, things that you do to try to hedge and to do this, but you know what? You need to look at the bigger picture. And then when the market starts to realize whatever it is that you're thinking about and comes around to your particular point of view, think about how long the real estate market moved higher, even though it shouldn't have. It moved higher for probably 3 years more than it should have, right?
Yeah, that's true.
If you would have shorted the real estate market during that period of time, you would have gotten slammed. So if you would have bought real estate, or at least an investment in real estate, and then sold it when it started rolling over, assuming you didn't get caught in something and get, you know, stung by that, you would have been in better shape. But not going to where it may be a good idea because of all these other outside noises and because your fear of that is something that is holding you back. So you have a couple of choices. Either stop being scared and either go short or long, whatever the decision is that you want to do, and have convictions of your means, but also realize that the bigger picture is what is right, not you. And then at the end of the day, you know, try to, either, you know, kind of go with the flow with that, or, you know, utilize an outside manager of some sort so that your personal overviews, which, by the way, you'll tell me, I know you'll agree with me, have been wrong since that for the last 2 years, right? Or year and a half, whatever it is. So,
yeah.
You know, that kind of is painful as well. And you know what else? How many other people do you think are out there like you that have been waiting for the market to drop so they can put money back in, right? Because that's what you really want. You want it to drop back down, then you'll put money in, right?
Yeah, and I probably wouldn't. Personally, I wouldn't put money back in unless there's a few thousand points or up.
Right, okay, so that means that's yours. A couple thousand points is yours. Somebody else may be 500 points. Somebody else may be 100 points.
Yeah.
Therefore, there's a continual bid to be in this market, no matter at what level. That's why every single time the market even drops 0.5%, people are buying, even on crappy news. Just consider that.
Yeah, personally, I wouldn't feel comfortable buying the broad market, but what I could do is selectively buy companies that I think are attractively valued, or special situation or something like that, or I'd give it to like a commodities manager, someone who's trading in and out.
Right, no, I think that's the right thing to do. I think that's also because, you know, get somebody that can be more objective than you. And this message goes out to a lot of people listening, so that's why I'm really spending some time here. But bring in somebody that's more objective to you than you. And, yeah, don't go after the big, broad market, because I could see how you could say, oh, it's either being manipulated or the stimulated or whatever. Go after a stock, pick whatever the name is, whatever it is, that you did the research on, follow the trend, and then, you know what? At least you could understand what's going on with that individual company times 10, let's say, that you may invest in.
Yeah.
You know, that's a better way to play it.
Andrew, does your firm offer commodities advisory trading?
No, we don't do that. I mean, that's a whole different animal. That's a whole different, yeah, more than an animal. It's a vegetable. It's something different. It's a different planet.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of places out there that you can go look. It's a tough place to be because of the futures market and all that. But, you know, you could use ETFs for that as well and other managers. All right, I got to run. I got to skedaddle. Tony, you're the best. I appreciate you listening.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye-bye. All right, next up we have, let's see, Kevin from Alabama. How's it going down there, y'all?
Oh, things are well. Things are well here in Alabama. We got great weather today.
Yeah. Do you do that y'all down there, or is that just Georgia, Florida, and all that?
No, there's a few y'alls down here.
So what's on your mind, buddy?
Well, I had a question about stocks in particular. I'm just kind of curious on how this works. As you know, Motorola has recently split into two separate companies, Motorola Mobility and Motorola Solutions. Before the split, the stock was trading somewhere around $8, $9 a share. Now, since they've split two companies, both stocks are trading at about $32 and $38. So I'm just kind of curious as to what's the logic behind, or, you know, how does it go from a nine stock to two stocks trading in the 30s?
So if I said magic, that's not going to do, I bet, right? So
right.
Let me tell you how it works. First of all, on you know, with that discussion, you would think you'd have to scratch your head and say, wait a second, hold on, let me get this straight. So you have one stock at $8, let's say, and now you have two stocks each trading at 30. So, wow, what a great deal, because I just give up one share and I get 30. Well, here's what happened. They actually did what's called a reverse split, and then a divestiture of both the shares. So if you owned one share at $7 and that was $7, in the end you would actually have two stocks, theoretically, that would equal $7. After it all happened. Now, obviously, you can't get half shares and things of that nature, so you just probably get paid out in cash for that. But what would happen is that they actually did a reverse split. So if you get a split of 1-for-10, let's say, usually, and you have $100 stock, you're going to get a stock now that is valued, let's say, at $10, and you'll have double the shares. That's a traditional split, okay? You know, a 2-for-1, a 3-for-1, a 10-for-1. Now, on a reverse split, the opposite is true. So now you have a stock that's let's say, at $10. And if you had a reverse split that was, you know, 2-for-1 on the reverse or 1-for-2, you'd have actually half the shares and you would have double the price. So that's what happened in the case of the Motorola. And anybody that's listening out there, if you want to, I mean, it's pretty simple. Just, you know, you could look this up on the web. And most of the time, the investor's relations area on the company website has that information. So I don't know if that helps you out at all. Yeah. So really. Yeah, so that really wasn't, again, it wasn't magic. It was just the way they did it. It looked much, you know, and you have to wonder with the Motorola situation, you know, for a long time, there was a lot of call for splitting this company up. And I guess if you were in management, you'd want to have some kind of equality there. But you know that if they want to split it up, one side's going to be better than the other. And the big question out there is which one? You know, is it the Motorola Solutions or the Motorola Mobility?
Mm-hmm.
Big question. So we'll see. All right, Kevin.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, thanks. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. All right, coming to us from the State College of Pennsylvania and Penn State. Hey, Zach, my friend, we go back and forth emailing a bit. How are you?
How you doing?
I'm it's great.
Nice to finally talk to you.
I know. You put an email to a face, right? Or at least to a voice.
Yeah. So, do you want me to just jump into the question?
Or? Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. I was wondering, I've been trying to hedge. You know, I'm kind of nervous with the way the market's been moving.
Mm-hmm.
And first I bought the inverse S&P 500, and I realized that I was getting, you know, first of all, I'm holding a lot of capital, and, you know, I'm getting nailed recently on that. I mean, I know the rest of my portfolio is doing pretty well, but it just doesn't really seem efficient.
Right.
So So then I decided to buy options. You know, my dad has an account at Merrill. That's how it kind of works. And we had to fill out all the paperwork and whatever. And I bought put options on the NASDAQ about a couple of weeks ago, like right after that collapse. Of course, I buy it on the day when they shoot up.
Right.
So now, like, I bought out of the money then. So now they're like 15% out of the money or 10% out of the money. I was just wondering, you know, for doing that, how, first of all, how do you do it? And second of all, how do you choose which option to buy?
That's a good question. Yeah, when you're looking at options, there's, you know, the problem is they're built in two parts. Number one, you have what's called time value, and you have the amount of time that it's going to expire, and then you have what's called intrinsic value, or the value of the actual in or out of the money. So you're out of the money, you don't have any intrinsic value. All you have left is time value. The problem with options right now, or in general, is that while they may be cheaper because of volatility issues, et cetera, lately, the problem that you're going to have is you have a time limit. So you have 30, 60, 90 days, whatever it is. Okay, that's fine if that's all you want to cover yourself for. But if you want to protect yourself and you're looking to, you know, hedge, quote-unquote, hedge the portfolio, you don't want to really tie up a lot of capital in options either, especially because they expire. And a lot of people that trade options will tell you that you want to get some that are close to being in the money so that at least you don't get really way out of whack in terms of, you know, getting hurt, so to speak, when, you know, the market moves in away from you. And then the other thing that I'll mention to you is, you know, you have to ask yourself, what are you hedging against? Are you hedging against a gigantic collapse for one day, 2 days, 5 days, you know, a month? Are you hedging for, hey, I like my stocks, but I there's a lot of uncertainty out there, so I'm just going to broad base it? Or is it something like, hey, you know what? I think that I want to make money if the market moves down, so I'm going to buy these puts. I think those questions, which one of those fits you best?
Well, so I was nervous about the first 3 months of this year. I can't believe it's still going up like this. So I saw puts as kind of, I bought it like slightly out of the money, and I gave myself about 2 months. You know, I bought them sometime in January,
right,
and gave myself to March.
Right.
And so I gave myself a couple months, you know, and then this way if they declined, you know, if the NASDAQ declined 10%, you know, it would have covered a lot of my losses.
Right.
So
you're looking for short-term to intermediate hedging against your portfolio. The problem right now is, as we know it, that the market only has one direction. There's seemingly an unlimited amount of cash coming from a variety of places, whether it's overseas, whether it's moving out of bonds, because, you know, now all of a sudden there is the, you know, better economy that we're seeing, at least statistically, from the Fed, and they're keeping their pedal to the metal. And almost every single day you notice that even when the market seems to want to go down, it doesn't. Yeah. And there's this, you know, safety net underneath. I mean, you can't even get a flat day anymore, much less, which is pretty crazy. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, you know. But I think what you want to do is, you know, first of all, maybe you want to build on your options. Don't start out with a big position right away if you don't think it's going to be like a flash crash situation or whatever. And I would be careful that you don't buy them too far out, because the further you buy them out, the more you're going to pay in time value, which will, in fact, reduce every single day that you hold them. So maybe 2 months at the most, like you did, or maybe even a month. Remember that options expirations on the third Friday of every single month. So, you know, as you roll over, it gets even worse and worse. We just picked up some VIX options. Actually, it's interesting because 2 days before options expiration, we picked up some VIX options on the April 20s. We put calls on it. And even though the VIX actually moved sideways, we made 25% on it in 2 days. And that's because we got the roll on it, which was interesting, I thought, and because there's a lot of people looking to buy protection at these levels. So all of a sudden, they're expiring, right? Theirs is expiring, and there's a little trouble in the Middle East. So the VIX is an interesting way to play it, although, and the other thing is on the VIX, there's a ton of people that are short the VIX right now. Ton. So everybody's weighing heavy on that side. So I think you're on the right track, Zach, but it is a difficult situation in a bullish market. And, you know, whether you believe it or not, whether I believe it or not, or anybody out there believes it or not, you know, the market is moving higher, or it has moved higher against all odds of what people thought was going to happen. And just if you want anything to blame on it and understand it, just blame the massive amount of monies that were put in stimulus that flowed down to people that went back to corporations and the amazing amount of growth in the emerging markets. I think that explains it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, Zach, be good. Have a good time in college. And when I'm up there, maybe we'll pay a visit to the Wrath or something up there.
All right, man. I'll see you.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye. All right. All the way from the cold state of Michigan is Jeff. How you doing? You hope you staying warm?
Always.
I heard from a friend that there's it actually got warmer up there, somewhere in the 40s, huh?
It's very nice out right now. Nice and sunny.
You know, everybody likes to talk about the weather because they know that I'm down here in Florida, so I always kick it off with that. For this. So anyway, so what's going on? How can I help?
Just was curious. Love investing and love the research and listening to your podcast. But my question relates to that time of year, taxes. How do I minimize my exposure to taxes, capital gains? What are the tips and the tricks the pros use?
Yeah. Well, there's first of all, let me kind of, that's a good, the ending of that, what are the tips and the tricks that the pros use? And there's two different answers, I think, to that. You know, they have these tax-efficient mutual funds that are out there. And essentially, what a tax-efficient mutual fund does is it invests in whatever it invests in, right? And come the end of the year, they do something called tax harvesting. So they look for a stock that's done really well that maybe they want to sell, and they sell it. And then they look for a stock that's done, let's say, poorly, and they offset, or at least they look for something that's done poorly, and they use that to offset the gains on the other side. Okay, that's fine. That's all fine and good if you're kind of really being a very slow investor and you're investing in, I'm just taking a number, 10 stocks and, you know, you have that kind of situation. But what if, I think you're asking me a little bit differently, what happens if you're actually doing a little bit more of trading? You know, what do you do under that circumstance? Because the first answer and short answer is there's not much you can do about short-term capital gains. You know, if you do it and you're trading, you know, there's not much you could do there because you're only going to get into the long-term capital gains holding something for over a year. Now, some of the things that you can do are something like this, that if you are selling the stock because, you know, you believe it's going to go down, let's say, you know, that's, you can actually, we just had a call about this, you can actually do some things like write or buy a put on it, let's say. You know, this way you can hold the stock. So let's say you have Apple and you like it, but you're nervous that it's going to go down, so you want to sell it. But you know what? You say, if I sell it, I pay taxes on it. And instead of just selling it outright, maybe what you want to do is you want to have some protection. And so you buy a put on it, as an example. Now, the hope is that your put will expire worthless and the Apple just keeps on going higher, of course. But what you'll do is you'll set yourself a break even on the downside. And if that happens, you'll make money on your put probably. And you'll probably actually make money on from where you bought Apple, I would say. So that doesn't really help your situation.
Right. Either way, I'm funding Uncle Sam.
Right. Let me tell you something. Let me just, in all seriousness, I mean, this is a problem because, you know, who wants to pay taxes? But generally speaking, the only way you're going to get around it is end of year, you know, washing around your portfolio and doing some tax harvesting. And in a way, I got to tell you, you know, I don't think anybody ever says, you know, aside from regular deductions and things like that, you know, hey, I work for a company, I make $50,000 a year. That's great, but damn it, I got to pay taxes. I mean, it is what it is. You're making money, you got to pay taxes.
Got to pay for QE2?
Yeah, exactly. Who else is going to pay for it? Isn't it your pleasure?
Yeah.
And don't forget, your kid has to pay for QE3.
Right.
You know? So there's really no answer, I think. I think in terms of, you know, minimizing things, obviously you could do retirement plans and things of that nature to put as much as you can and fund it and deduct money in IRAs and 401ks and pension plans. But aside from that, and not trying to oversimplify the situation, I mean, for your kid and you're doing it for college costs, you know, I know you may want to invest, but what about a 529 plan?
Sure.
You know, so if you would do a 529 plan, when you put the money into the 529 plan, basically all of the money will grow tax deferred, and you take it out for higher education, it's tax free on withdrawal. The only problem is you can't just wrap in a brokerage account usually in a 529.
Right.
So that may be, you know, an issue there. But the other thing is you have to wonder, you know, does it make sense for his education fund if you just want to be long for a while and take a couple of moves in and out of the general market in a year? Does it make sense to have a 529 plan instead of having all the aggravation with the tax, et cetera? And will the tax deferral be a better long-term situation for you than having an account that actually has short-term trading gains and losses? So that's what I would think about.
Yep. Okay.
Check out the 529s out there. There's a lot of them out there. Different companies, either brokerages have them or the mutual funds have them. Fidelity has it. T. Rowe Price has it. I think Schwab has it. Fidelity has it. You know, they all have them. Check that out as an idea, because then he'll have the money tax-free one day.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, Jeff, keep warm. Speak to you soon, buddy.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we also had a couple of, actually a lot of emails and questions, and people said, oh, I don't want to be on, and, you know, I'm nervous, whatever it is. So could you do me a favor and just answer the question? So I got a lot of those. I pulled out a few of them I thought were really interesting. And I thought I'd you know, kind of discuss that. There was a question here from Mike. And he says that, I'll spare you all the nice things everybody said. But thank you, Mike, for all the nice things you said. And he was talking about the time we had Mr. Griffin on. And he says his book was incredible and your interview was interesting. And he likes DOS a lot, etc. He says, what about alternative investments? Are there some things in the international real estate area that you can look at, other things that you can do, et cetera, et cetera? Or is this just a silly way to do things because the fees will kill you? So I think that's a good, you know, good question, Mike, in terms of what things can you have. You know, obviously in an IRA, there's limitations. But in terms of alternative investments, there are things that we like, generally speaking. You know, you want to look at international real estate. Look at it, not definitely get into it. I think is, you know, depending on how alternative you want to get, I am not into the partnerships or MLPs or any of the things that are very illiquid. I don't know. I just don't like that as an investment. And when it comes to things, when we think of alternative, we think of metals like palladium and all that. You can do ETFs these days. You know, that's the nice thing. There's pretty much an ETF for everything. As a matter of fact, just this week, the smartphone ETF opened. I think the symbol's FONE. Now that's just a sector, but you could also get, if you have the desire to get, whether it's natural gas or oil, or you can get things like palladium, gold, copper. They're talking about an aluminum ETF. You could do things like invest in specific countries or specific countries' sectors. So I think there's so many things out there in terms of the ETF world that I don't know. It seems to me that, you know, you're going to be in great shape with that. All right, let's skip ahead quickly to George. And George had a question. He said, I purchased your book and listened to your podcast. Thanks, George. And he's had some trouble understanding the information or the whole thing about the QE1 and QE2 and what it's all about. His two questions are this. Since the announcement of the Fed to purchase Treasury security bills in the QE2, that was back in August, I think, my first question surrounds the concept of how the Fed creates these bills and then buys them from themselves and pays themselves interest. Isn't this the same as being my own lender and borrower? Where would I get the money to pay the interest eventually? My second question is, well, let's stop there. let's see. So it's kind of like, I'm going to make a right turn. And the other guy says, no, I'm going to make three lefts. Well, three lefts is a right turn in the end. And it's also like saying, hey, I'm going to take this $100 out of my right pocket and put it into my left pocket. And now I have $200, you know, obviously not taking into account that we took money out of the other side. Kind of like, furthermore, a company just looking at their income and not their expenses. So I think, George, you're right on when it comes to this whole idea of where's the money coming from. And the money's coming from the Fed. Well, who's the Fed? Well, the Fed essentially is us in the end. And there'll be some question about that from some people who say, no, it's the bank. I mean, come on. You know, you're talking about close to $1 trillion. Where does the Fed just immediately come up with that money out of nowhere? Second thing is, where would I get the money to pay the interest? Oh, he said that. My second question, he says, revolves around how the Fed determines which bills to purchase. He said on one day they bought 1.74 bills, billion of the bills, and they were offering at 4 billion, and then they bought the 2013, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to us that what they're doing is they are trying to hit the center part of the curve so that they could actually keep the yield curve, George, very much in a inverted or not inverted, excuse me, a steep incline. Incline is the word I'm looking for. A very steep incline. And the point of the incline is at the short end of the curve, they are actually going out and allowing for lending by the banks to be very well rewarded, because the banks will actually pay a small amount at the short end and lend out at the long end. And that's good for banks. They know that they have to do well for banks. As a matter of fact, They talked about some additional stress testing for banks. Well, why do you think they're trying to firm all the banks up at this point so they pass the stress test? And then at the end of the day, we all know that it's all about perception. If the banks pass the stress tests, we all feel better. We all feel better. We put money in the banks and maybe we'll borrow money, et cetera. When that happens, the banks have more money and the things are doing better and business moves. When that all, you know, kind of comes into play, well, then that turns around and it helps the banks and so on and so on and so on. So, you know, is the stock market worth X amount? Is a stock worth Y? Well, it all depends on the perception of what it is to the person buying it. So all that the Fed is trying to do these days is really keep the perception really positive. Let's see. Here's a question from John. And this is kind of interesting because he's a recent college grad and he's going to med school in August. And he's been investing in the markets actively since he had some more free time. So I'm not sure why. Hopefully, maybe when you get into med school, you'll be working a little harder. I guess you're in between here, John. So he likes the podcast, et cetera. And he says, hey, he recently started reading the conference call transcripts instead of listening to them. I can cover the information faster, but I'm aware of I'm missing out on the vocal inflection. Do you think that makes a difference? You know, that's a great question because there are now hedge funds and companies that are actually hiring, let's call them well-trained ex-military types to listen in on podcasts, to watch a CEO on TV, to see what inflection they have in their voice, to see what kind of expressions they have on their face, to see what kind of, you know, maybe if they're telling the truth or expanding the truth or whatever it is. So I think there is something to be said about that. Now, here's what's nice. Obviously, you're aware that most companies, if not all, have the recorded conference call that is stored. So if you, John, if you're reading along and you find something that may be interesting, well, just go and pull it up online and then skip to the part that you want to listen to. They also asked about the question about a margin squeeze on commodity-dependent companies is already priced in, if I think that. Do you think there is still a valuable place on that strategy? Well, that's a good question because right now we know from a lot of companies that there is a margin squeeze going on. We know that they're talking about how they see that, you know, the high rates of whether it's you know, corn products or rice or coffee or cotton are going to bring down their margins, but it doesn't seem that investors are paying any attention. Right now, you know, we do have analysts that are, you know, giving margin estimates, and companies seem to be doing pretty well to beat them, which seems to be the usual way of things these days. And then the stock goes up hysterically. We saw that last week or 2 weeks ago that Cisco's margins, you know, came in a little bit tight, and but yet again, you know, that stock got beat up, and their projections were pretty off. But you have other companies that come in right in on their margin, and margins still look pretty good. So the question is, who is sucking up all of that excess cost? Right now, we didn't see any major push through to the CPI, even though last week's CPI was pretty hot. And at the same time, we didn't see any significant amount of movement in earnings. So it's there somewhere. So I agree with you. And so I hope that answers that question for you. I think we'll hit one more. Let's see here. We have so many here. Let's see here. Long-time listener, option strategies. There's a lot of questions here on options. Josh asked me this. He says, I'm a long-time listener, and it's not often that he hears about option strategies. And when he heard the last podcast on options, he wanted to ask something, and he says, what about where are the top option strategies that you can use, and which ones do you most commonly use, et cetera? And what platforms and trading platforms do you work with or do you know of that are pretty good? Let's start with the second question first. You know, I would check out for information on options. There's a lot of different places to look, but you have Options Express. You have Options Monster, our friend John Najarian. You also have Interactive Brokers and Thinkorswim. Thinkorswim is probably one of the better platforms to do analysis and projections for the for options. But, you know, one of the things is that, you know, options, as we've discussed, have a time limit. They have limited liquidity. Our concern when we really work with options is, you know, what is our end game here? Are we using options for profit motive or are we using it for protection mode? So I think you have to look at that first. One of the things you can do is what I would say is that what we like to do is utilize individual equities or ETFs, whatever it may be, in the portfolio and use options either for protection or for enhancement. Enhancement, I mean covered calls. We haven't done a lot of work with options. There's so many opportunities in individual securities to work with, and you don't have the time limit and the potential volatility as well as the illiquidity issue. So I think that right now I would look at something like, hey, you know, looking at in this market environment, selling some puts if you can to actually enter into stock positions. So for example, we'll use Microsoft or another company. But Microsoft, let's say it's a $27 or so, and you say, you know what, I'm willing to buy Microsoft, maybe if it hits 26, 25, whatever the number is. Well, you could sell a put, and if the stock goes down, you're obligated to buy it. So that would be good. You get the premium on the put, and you can then buy the stock at the lower price. So then you get a lower cost basis, and that doesn't happen. Well, you get to keep your premium. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing would be that I'd use covered calls. I mean, you could pick up, for example, on an Apple covered call, if you want to pick up Apple shares, you have 100 Apple shares, and you have, let's say, you want to protect some of that. Well, you could pick up a sell a call that's maybe at, I'm picking a number, 260, and maybe you pick up $15. So you have $15 downside protection and about a $15 or $20 upside opportunity or something of that nature. You have to take a look at the exact numbers, but out to April and May. And then finally, the other thing would be to utilize like the VIX or possibly other indices that have volatility to protect the portfolio. You know, we talked about that a little bit earlier. So those are pretty much the things that I would look at when it came to options right now. So I hope that helps. And the last question here, we have Mike sent us a question. He asked us about rebalancing. And he says, what is the proper period for periodic rebalancing of the 4Ks, 401Ks? For example, other than 2009, I generally sold in May and went to cash until the fall when stocks generally rebound through the new year. You know, the old sell in May and go away. Also, being in my early 40s, I keep around 20-25% cash on the sidelines with the remainder split between international growth and value stocks. I am not in bonds at all anymore because I think rates have nowhere to go but up. All right, so Mike, you obviously have your overview, your economic and your macro overview of the markets. And I think that the proper periodic rebalancing, if you're doing a standard rebalancing, let's say it would be every 6 months, but that doesn't take into consideration if you want to be more of an active investor. If you want to be more of a kind of a lazy, passive investor, then you could probably get away with somewhere about a quarterly or semi-annually rebalance where you'd say, okay, I'm going to have, you know, 80% in equities and 20% in bonds or whatever the number is, 50-50, 60-40, and make sure to rebalance that and reallocate that. Because these days, markets are, you know, moving, and, you know, a week, a day, a month, or 3 months could be much different for a particular sector. If you're broad-basing it, it doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, if you're just going to say, well, I'm going to be in, let's say, 60% in equities, 10% in international, and 20% in bonds and the rest in cash or some other variation or summation of that, then the bottom line in all this is that if that's what it's always going to be, then once a year is probably just what you want to do. But I wouldn't do it at the end of the year when everybody does it. I'd pick another time. The other thing is that, you got to consider at 40 years old, is that what you want to do is just go by that very simple adage of sell a man, go away, and, stick with that in your investments. I don't know if that's really a really well thought out strategy that can be proven to work. I just consider it. Just consider it. So anyway, hope that helps, Mike. And I thank you all. I have so many other questions. I'm going to answer some by the email, and hopefully I picked out the best that you could listen to. And I hope you enjoyed this show, the episode number 200 on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And we'll be around next week with some more exciting guests. Of course, you could always write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And you know where to find us for all the updates and everything you need over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Also on Facebook, on Twitter. Definitely sign up for Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, one big word, Andrew Horowitz. You get instant updates of whatever we put on the blog and when the podcasts come out and all of that. Until next week, we'll see you soon. Have a great weekend. Have a great President's Day. I wish you the best. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.